Hello, my name is Aaron, and you are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 25th on IRIS. Our first front page article, Council Bluffs School Board gets first look at possible return to learn plans by Tim Johnson. Remote instruction, on-site instruction, and alternating between the two might be all part of the 2020 to 2021 school year. Members of the Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education got their first glimpse of that during their meeting Tuesday. Administrators see three possible phases: remote learning via online instruction, on-site classes with added safety precautions, or a hybrid model with a combination of online and on-site instruction, according to Corey Vormanth, Chief Academic Officer for the school district. Quote, "All of these plans are still a work in progress," he said at the outset of the overview he presented during the meeting. "All three of these plans may be used flexibly. We may be moving in and out of all three plans as we move through the school year," end quote. Unlike last year, virtual classes would not be voluntary, Rothman said. "All student work would be required, and all student work would be graded," he said. School officials do not want students to get any further behind than they already are from last spring's unplanned closure, Forthman said. "Teachers will need training to put credit classes into a virtual format. This will probably be done during their summer academy, with fine-tuning during the school year. It's something that will be new to all the teachers," he said. With the hybrid plan, all students would receive virtual instruction on Mondays, which are shortened so teachers can attend professional development sessions in the afternoon, Borthman said. Then half of the students would attend classes at school buildings on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and the other half would go to school on Wednesdays and Fridays. On the days students are not physically at school, they would participate in classes through a link with the class section held on those days. Teachers would be at school every day teaching one group of students in person and the other group virtually. The hybrid model would allow schools to keep class sizes smaller and spread students out. It would also be easier for students to practice social distancing. If students did attend classes at school buildings, whether on alternate days as part of a hybrid model or for daily on-site instruction, they would have their temperatures checked each time. They would need to practice social distancing, and buildings would receive enhanced cleaning and sanitizing, according to a chart Vorthman presented at the meeting. At this point, the district plans to encourage but not require the use of masks, Superintendent Vicky Murillo said. Board member Jill Shudak asked if a student's temperature would be checked if they rode the bus. "The bus company is not comfortable with bus drivers taking temperatures," Murillo said. "The bus drivers are going to be required to wear a mask," she said. "The monitors are going to be required to wear a mask." Board member Troy Arthur was concerned about the coronavirus possibly being spread by students on buses. "If they're on a bus and they're sick, that's awful," he said. "School districts will not know what restrictions the state will require at the time school starts until late summer. Maybe by the end of July," Forthman said. "We would have to abide by any emergency declaration the governor put out," he said. "If there's not an active emergency declaration, local control would prevail." During closure, nutrition services were able to provide countless meals to our students, Board President David Kozar said. "If we are in a return plan, as with a hybrid, have we learned enough from our closure time to be able to provide meals?" Murillo said the district was considering whether to send several days' worth of meals home with students if the district implements a hybrid plan where students attend on alternate days. "It's hard for some parents to pick up meals at lunch times," she said. Arthur asked whether any of the staff members were in a high-risk group for COVID-19. Gary Milborn, Chief Human Resources Officer, said there were. There were multiple people that have reached out, and I assume there will be more who will reach out when they get a little more information, he said. The school district is working with kids and company to figure out how child care could safely be provided and how the program could accept additional children if the schools are in virtual or hybrid mode, Murillo said. At Kids and Company, we're building plans that would work if any of these plans would have to happen, said Board Vice President Chris LaFarla, who is also the executive director of the Council Bluffs Schools Foundation, which operates the Kids and Company program. School districts must submit a plan for remote learning to the Iowa Department of Education by July 1st, Forthman said. In order to provide four-credit remote instruction, all students will need to have access to class material. The district knows from last spring's experience that not all students have access to the internet, Forthman said. On Tuesday, the board approved an arrangement with the City of Council Bluffs and the City Carter Lake to form a group to provide free wireless internet services to Carter Lake residents, to the extent technically possible and financially feasible. The agreement includes forming a Council Bluffs area Wi-Fi consortium, which would be governed by a council with 7 members, the chief technology officer from the school district or his or her designee, an appointee of the superintendent, the chief information officer of the City of Council Bluffs or his or her designee, the mayor's chief or staff appointee, the mayor of Carter Lake or his or her designee, a member appointed by the Iowa West Foundation Board, and a representative appointed by Google, who will be a consortium partner. The agreement would last for 5 years, with the possibility of being renewed 1 year at a time. The Governance Council will, in turn, appoint representatives of each of the parties to a technology committee to make recommendations at the direction and request of the Governance Council. Carter Lake Mayor Ron Cumberledge has signed the agreement on behalf of the City of Carter Lake. The Council Bluffs City Council is expected to take up the matter during the next meeting. Our next front page article, State Reports 6 New Cases of COVID-19 in County by Mike Brownlee. The state listed 6 new cases of COVID-19 in Pottawatomie County on Wednesday afternoon. Because of the timing of reports, Pottawatomie County Public Health reported no new cases on 2 p.m. on Wednesday, though 2 additional individuals have been hospitalized. The county generally issues its update around 2 p.m., covering the previous 24 hours, while the state is constantly updating coronavirus.iowa.gov, which listed 632 cases just before 3 p.m. Pottawatomie County Public Health said new cases came in to the state after the county's reporting period. The state showed 626 cases earlier in the day on Wednesday. Pottawatomie County public health officials said they were unsure what the discrepancy was specific to this instance, but noted that in the past the state has duplicated test counts or inadvertently listed results from different counties before correcting. These numbers are updated all the time to reflect additional information that we might receive through the investigation process, said Amy McCoy with the Iowa Department of Public Health. For example, if we find out that someone actually lives in another county, we would need to reassign the case to a different county. Pottawatomie County Public Health is tracking 689 cases, which includes epidemiologically linked cases. The state does not track epi-linked cases. Pottawatomie County Public Health has said epi-linked cases are individuals who have had contact with a confirmed positive individual and are exhibiting symptoms, but have not been tested. The department provides assistance to those individuals and treats them like individuals who have tested positive. Coronavirus.iowa.gov lists 632 positive cases in the county out of 7,937 tests, for a positive rate of 8%. Pottawatomie County Public Health reported that an additional 5 individuals have recovered for a total of 450 recoveries in the county, meaning 65% of the individuals with the disease have recovered to date, according to the department's numbers. 2 additional individuals were admitted to the hospital for a total of 8 currently hospitalized. There are 194 individuals self-isolating at home. Iowa reported 317 new cases from Tuesday afternoon to Wednesday afternoon, for a total of 26,690, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. There have been 270,071 tests in the state for a 9.9% positive rate. The state listed 691 deaths, up from 688 on Tuesday. The state reported 263 new recoveries for a total of 16,842. Pottawatomie County Public Health said it continues to urge residents to continue to practice social distancing, wear a face covering in public, wash your hands often, use hand sanitizer, and disinfect surfaces regularly. If you are sick, stay home. Even those who are mildly ill spread the virus. A Test Iowa site is located in Council Bluffs at the Western Historic Trail Center, 3434 Richard Downing Ave. To get tested for COVID-19, you must complete the health assessment at www.testiowa.com and receive a testing date and time. All care health centers offers drive-up COVID-19 testing and helps those without transportation and or health insurance. Call All Care Health Center at 712-325-1990 for an appointment. COVID-19 cases in Southwest Iowa. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, Shelby County has 3 new cases, but saw its positive rate go down. Monona and Crawford counties have 2 new cases, and Harrison County has 1. Here's a look at the numbers in Southwest Iowa based on data from the counties in coronavirus.iowa.gov. Pottawatomie County, 632 cases. Pottawatomie County Public Health is tracking 689, including epi-linked cases, 450 recoveries per the county, 7,937 tests. 8% of those tests have come back positive, 11 deaths. Mills County, 31 cases, 25 recoveries, 1,795 tests, 1.7%. Harrison County, 45 cases, 40 recoveries, 888 tests, 5.1%. Cass County, 16 cases, 16 recoveries, 697 tests, 2.3%. Shelby County, 88 cases, 50 recoveries, 808 tests, 10.9%. Montgomery County, 10 cases, 7 recoveries, 711 tests, 1.4%, 2 deaths. Monona County, 64 cases, 23 recoveries, 697 tests, 9.2%. Crawford County, 644 cases, 382 recoveries, 2,703 tests, 23.8%, 2 deaths. Page County, 18 cases, 16 recoveries, 1,071 tests, 1.7%. Fremont County, 4 cases, 2 recoveries, 331 tests, 1.2%. Information about COVID-19. Symptoms in people who have been exposed to coronavirus can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The symptoms may appear in as few as 2 days or as long as 14 days after exposure. Most people experience mild or moderate symptoms that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. Other adults and people with existing health problems are among those particularly susceptible to more severe illnesses, including pneumonia. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend the use of masks when out in public. Make sure it covers the mouth and nose. Face shields are an option as well, as they cover the eyes. Public health officials recommend stay home as much as possible, self-monitor for symptoms, call your physician if symptoms appear, cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue or your upper arm, elbow, Wash hands frequently with soap and water. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects and surfaces. For those struggling with mental health during the pandemic, yourlifeiowa.org has several resources, including a hotline at 855-581-8111 and a text-friendly line at 855-895-8398. Also, the Hope for Iowa Crisis Hotline is available 24 hours a day. Call 844-673-4469. The University of Nebraska Medical Center has a COVID-19 screening app, OneCheck COVID, enables users to answer a series of questions and assesses their likelihood of having COVID-19. Based on the user's input, the screening app will issue a low-risk, urgent-risk, or emergent-risk assessment and guide the individual toward possible next steps. Our next front page article, 6-year report, Advance Southwest Iowa Helped 227 Local Businesses by Susan Payne. Advance Southwest Iowa Corporation released a 6-year economic development review on Tuesday. From 2013 to the end of 2019, Advance has completed 27 landed projects and assisted 227 businesses with economic development. These projects represented $203 million in capital investment and 330 new and retained jobs for Council Bluffs in Pottawatomie County, according to the report. Landed refers to the businesses Advance has helped from start to finish, either by expansion or establishing a footprint in Council Bluffs or Pottawatomie County, according to Advance Southwest Iowa Executive Director Paula Hazelwood. Advance expanded its efforts to attract new businesses, retrain, and grow existing businesses in 2018. In 2019, the organization added LAUNCH to its program of work, funded by the Iowa West Foundation to help build the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Southwest Iowa. LAUNCH's goal is to unearth entrepreneurs and provide the daily guidance, connections, and a sense of belonging they need to start or grow a business in Pottawatomie County, the report stated. Over a 6-year period, more than 200 businesses have helped in some way, Hazelwood said. We've helped them with something, whether it's finding a piece of real estate, connected them to the Small Business Development Center, or ran some data. Some were actual projects, but did not materialize for various reasons, Hazelwood said. Advance has helped companies such as EQ, School of Hair Design, Tyson, Warren, Distribution, Full Fledge Brewing, CHI Health, Lofredo Fresh Produces, and Omnitel Communications, along with others. We thought it was appropriate to do a 6-year capture, Hazelwood said. We have an internal customer relationships management system that tracks our activity. Those projects that are remaining in the active category are in the system as well. And now for our last front page article, Teacher, Veteran, and Popular Performer Dick Boyd Dies at 98 by Emily Sheeb and Tim Johnson. Many people knew Dick Boyd as a teacher. Others knew him as Ebenezer Scrooge. Most people knew him as Unforgettable. Boyd, a former middle school educator, military veteran, and community performer at the Omaha Community Playhouse, died Tuesday at the age of 98. Boyd was born in Nebraska City, Nebraska, and married Miriam Hieronymus in 1950, who died in November of 2017. They had 4 children. Boyd served in the Army Air Corps and was a World War II veteran of the South Pacific, according to a social media post from the Omaha County Playhouse. He went on to earn a bachelor's degree from Midland College and a master's in education from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He then went on to teach middle school language arts in the Council Bluffs Community School District for 28 years. He was the recipient of the district's Outstanding Teacher Award in 1998 and twice served as the president of the Council Bluffs Education Association. He was a good teacher, and he devoted his time to that endeavor, said Larry DeChant, who was principal at Kern Middle School during Boyd's last 10 years of teaching. he was really well liked by kids, and he was always very positive about learning and trying to inspire students to better themselves, to make something of themselves. He originated the role of Scrooge in the Playhouse's annual production of A Christmas Carol from 1976 to 2005. Boyd played Scrooge for 818 performances to a total audience of 442,885 people, according to a post on the Omaha Community Playhouse Facebook page. Miriam joined the cast of A Christmas Carol for 17 years when she grew tired of missing her husband during the holiday season. Many of his students attended that production over at the Playhouse, DeChant said. He was a renowned actor over there. Bob Schnipp, who played opposite of Boyd for many years, talked fondly on their friendship. Schnipp worked with Boyd for 29 years. Out of Boyd's 118 performances, 770 of those were with Schnipp. Dick and I had a special bond because I was the one that caught his flight from the Playhouse stage to the top of the bed, said Schnipp, referring to a scene from A Christmas Carol in which Boyd was lifted in the air. Schnipp recalled a time when Boyd's harness would unlock when he was mid-air and the show had to stop in order to get him down. During a performance when we were lifted from the bed, but Boyd was a little too far out and ended up smack against the bed frame, Schnipp said. He ended up ripping his lip open, and of course we didn't stop the show, so he had blood running down his face from the glitter was sticking to it. I don't think anyone noticed. Steve Prizman, longtime stage manager for A Christmas Carol, said Boyd never missed a show. He performed when he felt well or ill. Prizman said if he had a cold or if his knees were bothering him, the audience would have never known. Some of the cast would have never known. No show was ever canceled. He was at no point in his life the Scrooge that he capably portrayed, said Schnipp. He was always the transformed Scrooge that appears at the end of the story, loving, sharing, and interested in his fellow man. And now we'll move to the opinion page. Farewell, Teddy, by Kathleen Parker. As beauty exists in the eye of the beholder, so does the ugliness of a statue. Latest to the list of soon-to-be-fallen monuments is one of the President Theodore Roosevelt, who has presided over the entrance to New York's American Museum of Natural History for the past 8 decades. Set high on his steed and bookended by a Native American and an African warrior, both below on foot, the sculpture is supposed to represent Roosevelt's love of hunting and his dedication to conservation, both facets of his successful presidential mission to create our national park system. But in the midst of today's era and of outrage, his legacy is being viewed in a different, more modern light, with passions fully engaged after the death of George Floyd and police custody. Everything is in question, and some, it would seem, want to delete history altogether. At whose expense did Roosevelt collect all of those trophies on his hunting expeditions is the question of the moment, and by whose disenfranchisement and suffering were our beautiful parks created? Real people lived in some of those spots before ticket takers deployed at the garden gates, but so have real people lived in every place at time throughout history. Should we pretend otherwise, or should we review the past through a filtered lens of today's wokefulness? It's one thing to be informed and mindful, quite another to be perpetually wounded and vengeful. Had the two other men accompanying Roosevelt also been on the horseback, would the statue have been more acceptable? I wonder. As it stands, activists as well as the museum itself has decided that the trio's hierarchical construction implies superiority and servitude. In fact, the standing men were supposed to represent guides in the places Roosevelt liked to hunt and survey. They were helpers, in other words, not slaves. But never mind. Historical accuracy is no obstacle to self-absorbed nihilism. Thus, the consensus among the chosen few is that Roosevelt was a white supremacist, racist colonialist who exploited indigenous people and robbed them of their homelands. The headline on a recent Smithsonian magazine story about the statue seals the deal for resident minds. The racist statue of Theodore Roosevelt will no longer loom over the American Museum of Natural History, end quote. Hurrah, I guess. I've walked past that statue dozens of times and never much liked it. Too much testosterone for my druthers. And frankly, I'm not a fan of great white hunters off on safari to exploit the life of native species of land that's not their own, assisted by local talent who are treated as servants. By that standard, of course, there would be no male statues anywhere on the planet, given woman's inferior status throughout the bulk of history. For every Cleopatra ruling from her barge, there have been millions of women beaten or stoned to death by men, often guided by dogma created by men in the first place. Just saying. The world hardly needs to concern itself with my personal preferences, a concept I wish others would embrace. I'm constitutionally averse to depictions of suffering, human or animal, and yet I've learned much more from art books and museums about life and history from all of my years in public school classrooms. Some art deeply offends me, is hard for me to look at, and is nothing I'd ever want to hang on my wall, but I don't feel compelled to destroy it. Civilization, at least, has practice here, provides lawful means to change what we don't like. While vandalizing or destroying objectionable property may provide a monetary release, nothing good comes from letting loose the dogs of anarchy. The protests, by focusing their attention on destroying monuments, have moved past the death of George Floyd. There is value in purging the landscape of a past that continues to sow division. As a nation, we may be ready to let go of monuments to our past divisions. I know I am, but there's no erasing history if we hope not to repeat it. Our next opinion? Yes. Kids should be going back to school in the fall, by Joseph G. Allen of the Washington Post. I've spent more than 10 years as a forensic investigator of sick buildings. The stakes were often extraordinarily high. A hospital where 4 people had died and hundreds were at risk. A factory where workers were at risk of getting an irreversible respiratory disease called popcorn lung. A military base where housing was suspected in the deaths of 11 infants. In all of these investigations, I was asked, is it safe to go back to the building? If, after the appropriate controls were in place, my answer was yes. I always paused for one long final gut check question. Would my answer be any different if my family were involved? When people ask me whether schools are safe during the coronavirus pandemic, I ask the same question. Would I let my kids go back to school in the fall? The answer is yes. Let's first acknowledge a hard truth. Widespread school closures come with devastating costs. First, school closures are creating virtual dropouts. 20% of Boston high school students didn't log into class in May, and only half of the elementary school children in Philadelphia made daily contact. Even those with access to computers who do check in are not learning in the same way. This will increase our country's education gap and exacerbate racial and social inequalities, with impacts that will persist for years. Second, school closures impact kids' health. Students who are out of school are most likely to be sedentary and experience weight gain. Many also lose access to hot meals. Millions of children rely on federal programs for free or reduced meal prices. Third, a disproportionate burden of working from home is falling on women. Many are now working 2 extra jobs, household manager and homeschooling supervisor. This widens another gap in our society, as working women risk either dropping out of the workplace or face career advancement challenges that many men and those without children won't have. Finally, lockdowns put children at greater risk of abuse, neglect, exploitation, and violence. Full stop. Now for the good news. Kids are at lower risk from complications of COVID-19 and basic risk reduction control measures are working. On children, a study in Switzerland confirmed that we have known for some time school-age kids have extremely low infection fatality rates. Of the thousands of children found to have been infected, not a single one died. On prevention, we are seeing that in many hospitals, the number of infections of frontline doctors and nurses has dropped way down. Why? Strict controls are in place focusing on just three things: mask wearing, hand washing, and air cleaning. To get our kids back to school in the fall, we can start with similar strategies and then build in additional controls. My team at Harvard put together a report on risk reduction strategies that can keep kids safe. A few important recommendations: create a culture of health, safety, and shared responsibility. No single control strategy alone is sufficient, and no single individual is solely responsible. Reopening schools safely will require changing culture to a health-first mindset with everyone playing a role. Stay home if sick. Students with symptoms should be sent home immediately or quarantined in an open and well-ventilated space. Wear masks with breaks built into the day. Students, teachers, and administrators should wear masks to and from school, in common areas, and in classrooms when physical distancing is not possible. Schools should create mask-free time to reduce fatigue. Wash hands frequently. Cleaning and disinfecting all surfaces all day long is impractical. The better approach is frequent hand washing and the use of hand sanitizer. Clean the air indoors. Start working on air cleaning now. Schools should find out how much fresh air they can bring into their building. Increase the ventilation rate if you have a mechanical system and open windows if you don't. Supplement that with higher level filters and consider getting portable air purifiers for your classrooms. Physically distancing to protect individual health. Do your best to maintain 6 feet of the separation in class, but don't keep kids out of the classroom just because there isn't enough space. Remember, hospitals don't physically distance. They rely on other controls. Socially distance to slow transmission chains. Keep classes operating at subgroups and separate these groups as much as possible. This can help prevent many outbreaks from infecting the whole school. Make no mistake, there will be outbreaks in some schools even with those measures. Wherever we open schools will be determined by risk tolerance as a society. What will we accept for schools? If the answer is zero cases, that will require us shutting schools down for another year. The costs of that approach are too great, especially when there are proven risk reduction strategies at hand. Let's be clear that it did not have to be this way. Many countries around the world have shown that there is a way to control the numbers of cases. In the United States, we have so far failed to put necessary systems in place. I wish it was different. We can continue to push for things to get better, and maybe our government will course correct. Until then, we must forge a path with the reality we have, not the one we want. For the Year Review section, ugly medians. I travel Harry Langdon Boulevard and Veterans Memorial Highway nearly every day. The medians on Vets looks beautiful. You often see employees of mole halls tending to the flower beds. However, the medians on Harry Langdon look terrible. When first installed and planted, they looked fair. Gradually, plants started dying, but some of the business bushes remained. Then, last fall, some entity department chopped everything down and cleared the medians completely. I had hopes that this meant that in the spring someone would be replanting, but here it is mid-June and no sign of anyone taking interest in the medians. Now we have a lovely crop of weeds growing. This is a major entry into the city and very heavily traveled. I don't know if the state or the city is responsible for taking care of medians, but it sure does not give a very good impression to anyone using the street. By Norma Morford of Council Bluffs. Unresponsiveness from the governor's office. On June 17th, I called Governor Kim Reynolds to voice a concern. After voicing my concern, I asked the person I was talking to for their first name and last name so I could keep track of who I had talked with in the governor's office. The woman who took my concern would only give me her first name. She refused to give me her last name, and only after much prodding would she even give me her title. I then asked to speak to her supervisor. When her supervisor came on and again took my concern, I asked for her first and last name and position, and she also refused to give me her last name. When I asked her if this was a written policy of the governor's office not to disclose last names, she refused to answer and said that her supervisors had given her approval not to give out her last name. I then asked who her supervisors were. Turns out they are the governor's chief of staff, Sarah Gongol, and deputy chief of staff, Paige Thorson. Talk about lack of transparency. The governor's office is now directing staff members who are public employees that they do not have to give out their entire names or their positions to Iowa taxpayers who call with concerns. Yet, in order to have my concern registered, I had to give them my first and last name and where I live. Now, that seems pretty hypocritical. As taxpayers, we should always have a right to know who our public employers are and what positions they hold. Come on, Governor Reynolds, let's do better. In this day and age, the more transparency we have in the government, the better. By Vicky Rossender of Stanton. Why doesn't Ernst and her supporters say the same thing about Trump? Senator Joni Ernst's supporters run ads belittling Ms. Greenfield for having a failed business, even owing folks money. But Ernst supports Donald Trump, who did this numerous times, killing jobs and businesses along the way. Double standard Republicans, again, Randall Washburn of Sioux City. Republicans create extra burden for auditors. Our Republican Iowa state legislator just couldn't let it go. After the Senate's extreme voter suppression bill was resoundingly rejected by the House, the Senate had to slip into the budget bill in the middle of the last night of the session some unnecessary absentee ballot request regulations. If a voter provides incomplete or incorrect information when requesting a mailed absentee ballot, the county's auditor's office will be required to contact the voter first by telephone, then by email, then by physical mail, rather than using an existing voter registration database to fill in the blanks. The law currently allows for the use of existing voter registration database for correcting simple errors or incomplete information. This new budget bill prevents that from happening. Should you make a mistake, your already overworked county auditor will need to attempt several time-consuming ways of contacting you to verify that address and all other completed parts of the application are indeed valid, that you are who you say you are. This type of verification may be necessary when the county auditor has real concerns about the validity of the request. But this is not the case for minor errors or omissions. One can easily download and complete an absentee ballot request from the state of Iowa Secretary of State website. But heaven forbid you make a simple error that the county auditor could easily remedy by looking at the official voter registration database. This additional layer of regulation is just what voters and taxpayers do not want or need. Our recent primary was unqualified success for voter turnout of Republican, Democrats, retired citizens, working citizens, those with compromised health, busy young parents who are overwhelmed with childcare and work because absentee ballots were easily obtained. Our Republican Secretary of State, with the support of all 99 county auditors, 66 of whom are Republicans, sent the absentee ballot request form to every single registered voter. With COVID-19, the safety of our citizens required this special emergency measure. With a model of good citizenship, this was. This new budget provision feels like a slap on the wrist to our state and county auditors for taking care of their jobs and overseeing elections seriously. A rose to them for making it easier for citizens to exercise their right and duty to vote. A thistle to our Iowa legislator. By Barb Nelson of Stanton. Our last one, a presidential salute. Like all Americans, I am so reassured that our president can salute 600 times within the span of a few days. His achievement is one of the Guinness Books of World Records for sure. Such a demonstration of patriotism by Mr. Trump is definitely worth the discomfort he sustained in his shoulder that made him picking up a glass of water recently a bit challenging for him. Our president's selflessness leaves me speechless. By Stephen Pokernery of Urbandale. We don't have any obituaries today, but we do have in memoriam, Julia K. Lanson Dahlin, born November 25th, 1961, died June 25th, 2018. It's been 2 years since you left. Miss you so much. You will always be in our hearts and prayers and loved forever. Mom, Dad, and family. Moving to the sports section, we've got a bunch of softball and baseball news. Iowa high school baseball and softball teams playing it safe. Fans less so, schools officials say. By Aaron Murphy. Des Moines. The coaches and high school student athletes playing baseball and softball across Iowa are doing their best to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus, State Athletic Association officials say. The fans who are attending those games, on the other hand, are not always as cooperative in practicing social distancing. Iowa is believed to be the first state where high school student athletes resumed athletic competition. The state's summer baseball and softball seasons resumed with practices on June 1st and games on June 15th. Roughly a week into the season, at least a half a dozen Iowa school baseball and softball teams have experienced disruptions due to players or coaches contracting the new coronavirus, state association officials confirmed. None of the five cases involving baseball teams have been traced back to games or practices, said Jared Scheich with the Iowa High School Athletics Association. While other coaches, players, and umpires are doing their best to adhere to the recommended safety protocols established by the state public health department, some school officials have told him fans are not always as cooperative. Quote, the biggest concern that we're hearing from athletic directors and school administrators is there's a lot of interest right now in baseball across the state. It's the first live entertainment since state basketball, said Shrike, who said he attended multiple games across the state this past week. There's a lot of excitement, but it's also troublesome for some of our athletic administrators and school administrators as they continue to stress social distancing at these games. Shrike said some school officials have expressed concerns that fans are not adhering to the recommended social distancing. Fans are sitting close to one another, either in the bleachers or in personal lawn chairs. According to guidance provided by the state public health and education departments, schools must limit the use of bleachers for fans, encourage fans to bring their own chairs or stand, practice social distancing between different household units, and accept personal responsibility for public health guidelines. Trike said it's difficult for schools officials to police fan activity, as one athletic director who reached out said, with nothing else going on, how do you stop two people who are good friends from sitting next to each other, Trike said. The state guidance does not make any recommendation that fans wear a mask or other face covering. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend wearing a face covering in public settings where other social distancing measures are difficult to maintain, but some health experts have said the risk of the virus spreading outdoors is lower. But there is still a risk, especially for fans who gather support closely at games, an Iowa expert said. Clearly, it's safer outside, but if you're in somebody's face, you're in somebody's face, said Dr. Louis Katz, chief medical officer for the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center and a board-certified infectious disease specialist, so I don't think it's a good idea. Katz said he recommends people remain at least 6 feet apart or, if they plan to be closer to other people, to wear a mask. Most of the risk is to the fans that don't social distance, Katz said. The fans have to be paying attention to social distancing practices, and a lot of them aren't, and I think it's just dangerous. Gene Berger, executive director of the Iowa High School Athletic Union, said the decision to allow summer baseball and softball was polarizing in that parents and others had strong feelings, both for and against about whether the season should take place this summer. She said only three districts decided not to field a softball team, and the ones that are playing indicated a willingness to take whatever precautionary steps were necessary. The people who wanted to play They were going to do whatever they thought they needed to play, Berger said. They were willing to do whatever. At schools like Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson in Council Bluffs, teams and coaches have already gotten used to a new protocol. After the first 2 weeks of practice, you kind of get into a routine, so it hasn't felt like that big of a change for us, Abraham Lincoln coach Brett Allen said. We walk in, wear our masks, take our temperatures, and make sure nobody has anything. After that, our guys hopefully put that behind them and get ready to play a game. TJ coach Tom Giles said his team has developed a system, and actually this changes have cut down on dead time, quickening the pace of our games. Our kids have to pay more attention and make sure someone is on the foul balls. We always have a player ready to throw a ball back into play. In my opinion, it's actually sped up the game as opposed to slowing it down, Giles said. The ball is getting put back into play faster, rather than having to wait and wait for someone to go get it. School districts across Iowa have been choosing to follow the state guidance differently. Some schools have completely roped off bleachers. Some have a limited number of tickets. Others let fans in and leave it up to them to be responsible. One thing that has remained consistent throughout baseball and softball diamonds, however, are the lack of masks among spectators. Quote, I can't speak to why people are not wearing them other than that's their personal choice, end quote. Mason City High School principal Dan Long said, what I do know is that any of our workers that have at games are wearing the masks. And outside of that, it doesn't matter if you're the home team or the away team. You just see people making their own personal choice at the point of whether or not they choose to wear the mask. Said Newman Catholic baseball head coach and athletic director Alex Bull, quote, I think being outdoors, the weather, honestly, I really don't know. I think people are just starting to feel a little more comfortable, end quote. According to Bull, Newman Catholic reads off an announcement advising fans to adhere to social distancing and leaves it up to them to make their own decisions regarding the use of bleachers. We are asking adults to just be responsible, Bull said. They should know what's right, what's acceptable. They should be able to follow these guidelines without having somebody up in the bleachers calling people out. I just don't feel that should be necessary. As the defending Class 1A state champions, the Knights have seen many fans in the first two home games. Not all of them have been following these guidelines. Sometimes you look up there, it's not necessarily a worry of mine during the games, but sometimes you feel like we could be doing a better job, Bull said. It is difficult when a lot of people want to get out of the house and come watch a ball game. You've got to do your best and just act responsibly. On June 5th, the Central Iowa Metro League sent out guidelines for conference schools to follow. Mason City has 56 tickets that can be given out by players and coaches and fans are instructed to sit together with family and spread out between families. The rest of the fans are told to bring chairs to sit and watch from the outfield. What I've seen is that fans have been respectful of our guidelines, Long said. We've got in-stadium signs posted on the seating to help create some spaces. I see people respecting that up in the stands. Some other guidelines include concession stands not being allowed, team sanitizing equipment, and team spacing out as much as possible to minimize risk. Teams across the state, like Gehlen Catholic and Iowa Falls Alden, have had to suspend their seasons due to players testing positive for COVID-19. This is a growing concern for coaches. If you look at it, with 1A postseason starting on July 11th, if somebody comes in contact or tests positives after June 27th, the season is over with, Bull said. We have to be responsible adults if we want our season to last. Both Bull and Long say that now is the time to be extra cautious and make sure distractions follow the guidelines in place. Gunnar Davis of the Globe Gazette in Mason City contributed. Our next article, Iowa finds no violations at Tyson pork plant that saw deadly outbreak, by Ryan J. Foley of the Associated Press, Iowa City. Iowa's Workplace Safety Agency says an inspection did not uncover any violations at Tyson's Food, largest pork processing plant, where several employees died after contracting the coronavirus. The Iowa Occupational Safety and Health Administration closed its inquiry to the Tyson plant in Waterloo earlier this month without sanctioning the meat company. County officials and workers have alleged that in March and part of April, workers did not have adequate personal protective equipment to stop the spread of the virus and were not social distancing. The company says it has taken numerous safety steps since then, including requiring masks, screening for symptoms, and frequent testing. Blackhawk County has said that more than 1,000 of the Waterloo plant's 2,800 workers had tested positive for the virus or antibodies by early May. The Associated Press has confirmed that at least 5 workers have died after getting the virus. Most recently, a 44-year-old maintenance worker who died on Memorial Day after a lengthy illness. The other deaths have included a 65-year-old laundry department worker, a 58-year-old Bosnian refugee, a 60-year-old Latino father, and a refugee from Congo. Iowa OSHA says it inspected the plant April 20th after Democratic lawmakers filed a complaint alleging that unsafe working conditions caused the outbreak, which devastated the broader community. Within days, the plant suspended operations, reopening about 2 weeks later with new safety protocols. Iowa OSHA Administrator Russell Pyrie said in a letter dated June 11th that his agency found no violations of the Iowa Occupational Safety and Health Standards on the date of the inspection. You may have listed conditions on your complaint that were not within the scope of our jurisdiction or items that did not exist during the inspection, he wrote to Representative Ras Smith, a Waterloo Democrat who was among the complaints. Smith, whose district includes the plant and provided the letter to AP, said Tuesday he was baffled by the decision. He said the agency appeared to be protecting the company and not its workers. If they didn't find anything, why did Tyson feel the need to shut down and make some improvements? Smith said, it seems as though Iowan's OSHA is either complicit or refusing to do the right thing. State Senator Bill Dotsler, a Waterloo Democrat who also filed a complaint, said he was stunned. It's pretty clear that they couldn't find water if they were standing in a river, he said of Iowa OSHA. Iowa's OSHA database also shows that the agency's recent inspections of Tyson pork processing plants in Columbus Junction and Perry have been closed without finding any violations. We appreciate the important role of Iowa OSHA and are pleased with the results of its investigations, Tyson spokeswoman Liz Crossan said Tuesday. She said the number of active infections among its Iowa's workers continues to decline. The Iowa Department of Public Health said in early May that 951 workers at the Columbus Junction and Perry plants have tested positive for COVID-19 after outbreaks in them. The company has acknowledged that at least 2 workers at Columbus Junction have died of coronavirus. Iowa OSHA said that it inspected those plants only in response to media referrals. The agency has declined to inspect the Perry plant in April after receiving a complaint as outbreaks grew. Our last article, bagged grocery store salad sickens more than 100 people in 7 states. Des Moines. Associated Press. A recalled bag salad distributed a dozen Midwestern states by grocery stores has sickened 122 people in 7 states and sent 19 to the hospital, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Tuesday. The list of grocery stores included 2 located in Council Bluffs in southwest Iowa. The salad distributed by Hy-Vee, Jewel, Osco, and Aldi grocery stores is contaminated with Chlyspora, a parasite that can cause diarrhea, stomach cramps, nausea, and fatigue. The salad mix containing carrots, red cabbage, and iceberg lettuce is packaged as Hy-Vee branded garden salads. Jewel, Osco, Signature Farm brand Garden Salads and Aldi Little Salad Bar brand garden salads. All have been recalled and consumers are advised to not eat them. The CDC said the highest number of illnesses is reported in Iowa with 54. Illinois has 30. Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, and Wisconsin also have reported illnesses, which were first reported on May 11th and have been as recent as June 15th. The salads were sold in Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. The CDC said it continues to investigate and is working to determine if other recent cases of Clystridium infection are linked to contaminated ingredients in these bagged salad mixtures. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 25th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. You can find this recording and all of the other newspapers on our website on the podcast, iowaradioreading.gov. As always, thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.